Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at our studio in the East County Wellness Center in El Cajon. Today, we open our show with the latest updates on the deadly terrorist attacks in Paris over the weekend, along with responses from around the world and an update on local students studying in France. Here in California, we have news on a proposed ballot initiative to raise the minimum wage and another that would eliminate private utilities such as SDG&E and create a statewide public utility district instead. We'll have news about a court decision to reinstate the death penalty in California. Then on Green Scene, hear why climate change is dramatically accelerating fire danger, according to a new study. Our state is weeding through job applications for a new position, chief of California's new Medical Marijuana Bureau, and we'll tell you how you can apply. Governor Jerry Brown is taking heat for asking state workers to provide mapping of oil and gas resources on his family's ranch. We'll also tell you about a teddy bear drive to help kids in the hospital over the holidays, organized by local law enforcement groups. If you were here when President John F. Kennedy visited San Diego in June 1963, as I was, by the way, the Lemon Grove Historical Society wants to hear from you for a new video it's creating about this historic occasion, and we'll have details. On the second half of our show today, our newsmaker interview is Bobby Brink from Lions, Tigers, and Bears in Alpine. She'll be talking about the new tiger cub, Himmel, at their big cat rescue facility and about an annual holiday party that's truly a wild occasion. Americans are getting less religious, a new study has found, and we'll have details today. Then on Tribal Beat, learn about a new bill that Senator Bernie Sanders, a presidential candidate, has introduced to save sacred tribal lands at Oak Flat from destruction by copper mining. And finally, on our Sounds of History, Helen Oldfield from the Lemon Grove Historical Society presents a reading of a memoir about the lemon packing days gone by. We'll have all these stories and more on today's edition of the East County Magazine Show, where East County matters. This is Miriam Raftery with the latest on acts of violence in France that have rocked the world. On Friday, 8 coordinated terrorist attacks in Paris killed at least 140 people and wounded hundreds more, the worst tragedy to befall Paris since the bombings of World War II. ISIS, or the Islamic State, claimed responsibility for Friday's attacks, calling them the first of the storm, according to the New York Times. ISIS indicated the attacks were retaliation for French forces supporting a U.S.-led coalition against ISIS in Syria and Iraq. French President François Hollande called the attacks an act of war. In retaliation, France has launched massive airstrikes over the weekend against ISIS in Syria. NBC reports that the airstrikes destroyed an ISIS command post, arms depot, and terrorist training camp. Meanwhile, the United States sent ammunition to fighters from the Syrian Arab coalition battling ISIS in northern Syria, Reuters reports. Hollande has also declared a national emergency, ordering troops into the streets and sealing the borders of France. But he vowed not to give in to fear, as the terrorists hope. The president announced defiantly, "Long live France, long live the Republic." He also directed the nation to hold 3 days of mourning, commencing with tolling of the bells at Notre Dame, NPR reports. In the United States, President Barack Obama has ordered all U.S. flags worldwide to be flown at half-mast through Thursday to show respect for the victims of the attacks in Paris. In Washington, D.C., President Barack Obama expressed outrage at the terrorist acts, pledged solidarity with France, and vowed to do whatever it takes to go after the terrorists.
Once again, we've seen an outrageous attempt to terrorize innocent civilians. This is an attack not just on Paris. It's an attack not just on the people of France, but this is an attack on all of humanity and the universal values that we share. We stand prepared and ready to provide whatever assistance that the government and the people of France need to respond. France is our oldest ally. The French people have stood shoulder to shoulder with the United States time and again And we want to be very clear that we stand together with them in the fight against terrorism and extremism. Paris itself represents the timeless values of human progress. Those who think that they can terrorize the people of France or the values that they stand for are wrong. The American people draw strength from the French people's commitment to life, liberty, pursuit of happiness. We are reminded in this time of tragedy that the bonds of liberté and égalité and fraternité are not only values that the French people care so deeply about, but they are values that we share. And those values are going to endure far beyond any act of terrorism or the hateful vision of those who perpetrated the crimes this evening. We're going to do whatever it takes to work with the French people and with nations around the world to bring these terrorists to justice and to go after any terrorist networks that go after our people.
French soccer fans showed courage after the bombings outside the national stadium, singing the French national anthem while exiting in an orderly fashion. People around the world have taken to social media to show solidarity with France, with hashtags reading Pray for Paris. On Facebook, users changed their images to include the French flag, and Twitter did the same with its own logo. The investigation continues into those behind the deadly attacks, several of whom died at the scene. France 24 reports that three teams of gunmen and suicide bombers were involved in the terrorist attacks, according to French prosecutors. The attacks included simultaneous assaults on restaurants, a concert hall where 100 people were ruthlessly gunned down, even people in wheelchairs, as well as suicide bombings outside the National Soccer Stadium. Prosecutors believe the slaughter involved a multinational team with links to the Middle East, Belgium, and possibly Germany, as well as French nationals. At least one of the terrorist suspects was a French national, but Syrian passports were found near the bodies of two other suspects, according to the Telegraph. Reuters reports that a Syrian passport found by one of the gunmen who died in the terror attacks belonged to a refugee registered in several European countries last month, including Greece and the Balkan region. Three brothers are also believed to have been involved in the attacks, according to the Telegraph. One died, another is being questioned by police, and a third was released by French police shortly after the assaults. That third brother, Salah Abdeslam, is now the focus of an international manhunt, according to Associated Press. In addition, German police arrested a man on November 5th, before the bombings, after finding 8 machine guns, several handguns, and explosives in his vehicle. He was driving to Paris and is believed to have been part of the conspiracy, the Christian Science Monitor reports. The French terrorism attacks on Friday, the 13th, come less than a year after the massacre at Charlie Hebdo, a French satirical publisher, and at a Jewish delicatessen. Senior Iraqi intelligence officials claim they warned coalition countries of imminent assaults by Islamic State jihadists just one day before the Paris terrorist attacks, Associated Press reports. The attacks, though, could have been even worse. The Wall Street Journal indicates that a suicide bomber had a ticket to the France-German soccer game that French President Hollande was attending, but security guards found the bomber's explosives vest at the gate, and he detonated it outside the stadium. The Jerusalem Post, in an editorial, noted that the terrorist who executed the Paris attacks may have been part of an ISIS sleeper cell of European Islamic foreign fighters who returned from Syria and Iraq, or could have infiltrated France from outside, perhaps masquerading as refugees. The Israeli newspaper editorial concludes Europe and France should reconsider and reassess their policies on foreign migrants, their border control of migrants entering their countries, and their agreements to allow free travel from one country in Europe to another. But Nation of Change observes in an opinion piece that just one day before the latest attacks in Paris, similar terrorist attacks occurred in Beirut, Lebanon, killing at least 41 people there, predominantly Muslims. The piece concludes, let's be clear, Muslims are not the problem, they are also victims. Jihadists are the problem. Far more Muslims than Westerners have suffered at the hands of ISIS, Al-Qaeda, Hezbollah, and Hamas terrorists, the editorial concludes. While ISIS and its supporters took to social media to celebrate the carnage in Paris, Muslim leaders around the world have issued statements condemning the attacks, including the leaders of Saudi Arabia, Iran, Qatar, Egypt, and the United Arab Emirates, International Business reports. The Council on American Muslim Relations also denounced the terror attacks in Paris. To show solidarity with the people of France, cities around the world lit up landmarks in the French national colors, including, most poignantly, the New World Trade Center in New York, which replaced the Twin Towers, destroyed in the 9/11 terror attacks here. In San Diego, people created a makeshift memorial to the French terror victims in Balboa Park. San Diego State University took comfort in confirmation that all 34 of its students studying in France are safe. But at California State University Long Beach, students and faculty held a vigil to mourn the death of their student, Noemi Gonzalez, the first American casualty announced after the Paris terror attacks. Campus President Jane Close Connolly stated, "Taking the life of an innocent is an assault on our hearts and on our world. Noemi was an innocent of great promise, a light in our community." She concluded, "We can't help but experience the anguish felt by all those people of goodwill around the world suffering after these tragic attacks. Our hearts are one."
The Fight for 15 movement is taking its case to the voters, filing on Tuesday to put a measure on the ballot to raise California's minimum wage from $9 an hour to $15 by the year 2020. Supporters say the change would help 3.3 million low-wage workers in the state. Alma Hernandez with the Service Employees International Union, which is sponsoring the initiative, says with the high cost of living in the Golden State, it's impossible to support a family on $9 an hour.
What you see in many homes across California is you have families living, two to three families in a home, in an apartment, just to be able to make ends meet.
The measure would require businesses with more than 26 employees to start paying $12 an hour by July 2017 and gradually move up to $15 by July 2020, and they'd have to give full-time workers at least 6 paid sick days a year. Smaller businesses would have to start paying $10.10 an hour in 2017 and move up to $15 by July 2021. Opponents of the minimum wage say it burdens employers and forces them to cut jobs. But Hernandez says that hasn't been borne out in places like San Francisco that have already upped the minimum wage.
That's actually the reason why we're going directly to the voters, is that they see through the fear tactics that the other side employs. They all see prices around them continuing to increase and their wages continuing to remain stagnant.
Backers say they plan to start collecting signatures in January. Meanwhile, a similar ballot initiative that was filed earlier this year already has enough signatures to qualify for the ballot. That measure does not include the sick day provisions. For Public News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
California's Secretary of State has approved signature gathering for a ballot initiative that, if approved by voters, would end private utility corporations such as San Diego Gas and Electric, Southern California Edison, and Pacific Gas and Electric Company. Under the measure, the state would buy out these companies and operate a publicly owned California electrical utility district that would set electricity rates, build infrastructure, and provide power. The measure's backer, Ben Davis Jr., contends the state can provide power at lower rates for California customers and notes that nationwide, public utilities have 15% lower rates on average than privately owned utilities. The Sacramento Municipal Utility District, or SMUD, a public district where Davis served as rate advisory board member, averages 25% lower rates than California's investor-owned utilities. The initiative would allow existing public utility districts such as SMUD to remain. It's unclear, however, whether it would allow formation of new municipally-owned districts, such as the San Diego Energy Foundation's proposal for a public district to serve the San Diego region. An 11-member elected board, with each member representing a ward or district, would run the new state utility district. How successful or not a publicly owned utility district could be might hinge on who serves on that board, since the caliber of governance is always key. The recent scandals and at times failure to provide oversight by the Public Utilities Commission in California is an example of failed governance. But a key difference is that the PUC commissioners are appointed by the governor, whereas board members for the new California Electrical Utility District would be elected by the people and presumably could be removed by the people if they abused their powers. Utility corporations are expected to wage a vigorous campaign to oppose the measure if it qualifies for the ballot. Two prior efforts by Davis to create a public utility district failed to get enough signatures, but recent utility scandals and investigations into alleged undue influence by utilities on the Public Utilities Commission over the San Bruno pipeline explosion and other matters could spur more consumer interest in doing away with investor-owned utilities. voters might perceive publicly owned utilities as offering greater transparency, with profits flowing to the public treasury instead of corporate shareholders. Elimination of private utility corporations could have sweeping implications, potentially impacting everything from grid stability to wildfire detection and firefighting services provided by utilities, as well as an end to grants that private utilities give many local charities. If enacted, the measure would also eliminate the utility industry's powerful lobbying force that has pushed to slash incentives for consumers to invest in rooftop solar, back the nuclear waste dump at San Onofre, and lobby to provide incentives for building industrial-scale power facilities, such as desert solar and massive wind projects, as well as high-voltage lines, such as Sunrise PowerLink. Backers have until April 26, 2016, to gather the 365,880 signatures needed to qualify for the ballot. But under new election laws, if Davis succeeds in getting at least 25% of the required ballot signatures, California Senate and Assembly committees would be required to hold hearings on the proposal, UtilityDive.com reports. Davis is also pushing for a second initiative that would shut down California's last remaining nuclear power plant, Diablo Canyon. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
The death penalty is back on the books in California, more or less. On Thursday, a panel of judges on the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals rejected a lower court ruling that had declared the capital punishment system in the Golden State unconstitutional. But Professor Ellen Kreitzberg, who heads the Death Penalty College at Santa Clara University, says the appeals court judges didn't actually disagree with the earlier ruling. They just said they don't have the power to decide this claim.
They ruled on procedural grounds and did not comment one way or the other. They did not reject the claim that the system is so dysfunctional and it leads to delays so lengthy that it violates the Eighth Amendment.
Now, the death row defendant in the case, Ernest Jones, and his lawyers will decide whether to appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. But Kreitzberg says even if Jones gives up the fight, he probably won't be executed for a very long time, since the drug protocol California wants to use for lethal injections is under review by the Department of Corrections. The public comment period on that is open until January.
California still has no protocol that's in place. We're a year away now from being in a position to have an execution.
California hasn't had an execution since 2006. A ballot measure to repeal the death penalty failed in 2012 by a margin of 52% to 48%. For Public News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, networking for social justice.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
A new study published in the Bulletin of the American Meteorological Society predicts that the number of extreme fire risk days in California will rise from 10 days a year to 60 days a year by 2100, a six-fold increase. The study was conducted by the Department of Energy's Pacific Northwest National Laboratory and by Utah State University scientists. The scientists found that climate change is already underway and responsible for extreme fire conditions starting back in the 1990s, fires that go beyond normal fluctuations in climate conditions. There are things that can be done. Besides reducing greenhouse gas emissions to potentially slow or reverse climate change, investing in more brush clearing and firefighting capacity is critical. The cost of clearing brush can be costly, but battling big fires could be 30 times higher than the cost of prevention. The Environmental Defense Fund last year estimated that the cost of fighting wildfires can be expected to increase by almost 50% by the year 2050, or about $185 billion a year in the United States. Here in San Diego, fire season in the past has run from July through about November, after which CAL FIRE would shut down over half of its stations in the county. But in recent years, most of those stations have stayed open year-round due to increased wildfire risk from years of drought conditions. CAL FIRE has also been conducting an unprecedented number of controlled burns to create fire breaks and prevent larger fires. But some environmentalists, notably the Chaparral Institute, have contended that burning chaparral too frequently can result in grasses, which are even more flammable, taking over. Taxpayers, meanwhile, have balked at fire taxes aimed at funding increased fire prevention and firefighting services. Even the predicted El Niño could be a double-edged sword, bringing heavy rains that could help alleviate the drought. But heavy rains also lead to increased vegetation growth in fire-prone areas, vegetation that becomes a heavy fuel load once the dry summer months arrive, further accelerating the risk of more catastrophic wildfires. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
This is Leon Thompson with an unusual help wanted notice. If you'd like to earn about $10,000 a month and oversee the licensing, enforcement, and administration of marijuana in California, also helping to craft regulations of this fast-growing industry, Governor Jerry Brown has a job for you. A listing has been posted for a new state job, chief of the California's newly formed Bureau of Medical Marijuana Regulation. The state's Department of Consumer Affairs will be weeding out any applicants with criminal backgrounds or conflicts of interest. So if you're a grower or dispensary owner profiting off the seeds of your labor, sorry, you won't qualify. The ideal applicant will have an advanced or professional degree in public policy, administration or political science, as well as legislative or lobbying experience, knowledge of current issues facing the Bureau, and yo, dude, good people skills. The successful applicant will be appointed by the governor to turn over a new leaf, serving as California's first medical marijuana chief.
Governor Jerry Brown is facing scrutiny for asking workers in California's Department of Conservation to prepare a state map of oil and gas resources on Brown's family ranch. Associated Press obtained records proving that Brown last year directed top officials in the agency to assess and map the oil, gas, and mineral history and potential of his 2,700-acre ranch, including satellite imaged mapping and a drilling map. The internal complaint was filed by Jenny Catalano, a mapping specialist who alleges she has also faced retaliation for speaking out. It is illegal for an elected official to use state resources for personal purposes, although they can access public records such as previously existing maps of oil and gas resources. The Sacramento Bee reports that Burton Ellison, a former senior official with the state's Division of Oil, Gas, and Geothermal Resources, called the mapping work for Governor Brown, quote, a misuse of government time and employee time and resources, unquote. Several other ex-officials have said that they were unaware of any work of a similarly large scope done for a private party. The governor also tried to hide his actions from public scrutiny, according to Steve Bolin, oil and gas supervisor for California. Bolin told the Los Angeles Times that Brown became angry after he saw emails sent by Bolin to employees about his request. Bolin stated, he asked me to be careful about what I sent by email because of public record laws. So Bolin reportedly hand-delivered the report, according to Associated Press, which cited attorneys for the agency. Copies of whistleblower complaints are exempt from public disclosure, and it is unclear what consequences Governor Brown could face if it is found that he misused public resources for his own potential private gain. Republicans quickly accuse the governor of hypocrisy, since he has been a vocal advocate of clean, renewable energy, although the governor has also backed boosting oil production in our state while new green energy resources are rolling out. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
The San Diego Regional Law Enforcement Teddy Bear Drive is putting out an all-points bulletin on new stuffed teddy bears with tags still attached. They are asking the public to turn them in at any law enforcement station or at Chick-fil-A restaurants in San Diego County. The teddy bears will be donated and delivered on December 8th to Rady Children's Hospital to comfort sick and scared children. The Teddy Bear Drive was started by Coronado Police Officer Brian Hardy back in 1990, who says, "This is for all the kids." That first year, Hardy happened upon an empty toy donation bin at Rady Children's Hospital, so he loaded up his patrol car on his own time and brought in a dozen bears to donate in the name of the Coronado Police Department. Since that time, the drive has grown to include every law enforcement agency in the San Diego region joining in. About 60,000 stuffed animals are now collected each year. Cash donations also allow Teddy Bear Drive coordinators to replenish the supply of stuffed animals when those run out, so that every child admitted to the hospital year-round receives a stuffed animal. Money is also donated towards special keepsake memory boxes and comfort bears for the parents of children who pass away while a patient at Rady Children's. While the Teddy Bear Drive has various generous business and community group supporters, the bulk of the donations still come from law enforcement. Even though Hardy is retiring at the end of December, He said he feels like the drive is part of him, and he will continue to serve on the planning committee and donate. Another intent of the teddy bear collection is to let officers who often witness children in traumatic situations do something positive for children. In several instances, the drive has also touched some officers personally when their own child or family member was sick. In the 8th year of the teddy bear drive, and the day before officers delivered the bears to the hospital, Hardy's own 2-year-old daughter became critically ill from a ruptured appendix. He didn't tell anyone his daughter was a patient, but the word got out and she was given a teddy bear. After she was released, Hardy doubled his efforts to collect more stuffed animals for the hospital. All law enforcement officers and the court's probation department now participate in the drive, collecting new stuffed animals or monetary donations. Rady Children's Hospital also accepts toys and donations to bring smiles to the young patients year-round. For more information, visit teddybeardrive.com.
JFK Remembered, a screening of President John F. Kennedy's visit to San Diego on June 6, 1963, will be presented on Saturday, November 21st at 2 p.m. by the Lemon Grove Historical Society in the Lemon Grove Library. Helen Ofield, president of the Lemon Grove Historical Society, asks, if you were there that day, please bring your memories and join with former policemen, students, teachers, crew, military and civilians who were connected to JFK's visit. We'll be videotaping your memories for posterity. There will also be a display of memorabilia. Kennedy visited San Diego State College, now San Diego State University, and the Marine Corps Recruit Depot, and traveled by motorcade throughout San Diego just 5 months and 16 days before his assassination on November 22, 1963, in Dallas, Texas. For more information, you can contact the Lemon Grove Historical Society at 619-460-4353.
You are listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea.
The East County Magazine Show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Now stay tuned for part two of the East County Magazine radio show. Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso. And as you've just heard, that was a tiger growling named Taboo. We are here on location today at Lions, Tigers, and Bears with its founder, Bobby Brink. Bobby, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Now, I understand that you have a brand new resident that has just joined Lions, Tigers, and Bears, a tiger cub. Tell us about that.
Right. We just took in a new baby tiger, and Fish and Game found them wandering around the town of Hemet. So here he is.
Wow. And he's only 4 months old. He was, what, 2 months when you got him?
Yes, he's been here a couple of months now.
Amazing. And they don't know where he came from or what he was doing wandering the streets of Hemet.
Right. We don't know his history at all. We do know that he was very malnutrition, underweight. He's been declawed. He had a hernia from being overhandled. So we're getting him through his health issues, trying to get him big and strong. And we're probably going to do some surgery on his feet. And he's doing really well.
Well, he's certainly in good hands here. And he looks happy. He's running around jumping and bouncing and looking like a happy, healthy tiger cub. I understand you had a naming contest to choose his name, Himmel, which is after, of course, the late broadcaster Larry Himmel, who was so beloved locally and did so much to help broadcast the good works that you're doing here.
Right. Well, San Diego has a new tiger, so we decided to let everybody in on the naming. So everyone went on our website and picked some names, and then our committee narrowed it down to a few names, and then we put it to Facebook and voted, and unanimously it was Himmel, after Larry Himmel, who we much love, and he much loved Lions, Tigers, and Bears. Here he was a big part of Lions, Tigers, and Bears, and Conga the leopard was actually his favorite here, and we miss Larry dearly, and so Himmel will be a good reminder of Larry.
Yeah, that's a wonderful tribute to Larry. Now, I understand that you have a big event coming up on December 5th, your annual holiday party at Lions, Tigers, and Bears. And this is a little different than some other holiday parties you might have been to. Tell us a little bit about what goes on there.
Well, it's a good, fun family day where we can raise some much-needed funds to take care of all these rescued animals. But we give all the animals Christmas trees and Christmas presents. And they love to thrash the boxes and open up their gifts and carry around the Christmas tree in their mouth. And it's just good, fun family fun. And we have a bar for the adults and food and drinks and vendors. Lots of Christmas gifts for sale. And it's an open house to our facility. And we hope you'll come out and have some fun.
Marvelous. How many animals do you have here now at Lions, Tigers, and Bears? And tell us a little bit about some of them.
We have 60 rescued animals, 17 different species, and all come from either being badly abused, come from the pet trade, or closing down sanctuary, failing facilities, things like that.
Okay, and as the name implies, it's lions, tigers, and bears, but there's also a mountain lion, a bobcat, a leopard, lots of other things. I'd like to introduce now Tasha Matthews. Tasha is one of our wonderful interns who's joining us this semester from UCSD, and Tasha has some questions as well. Tasha, thanks for joining us.
Hello, and thank you. I know you have an incredible love for the animals, Bobby, and I was curious to know what keeps you inspired to do the work that you do.
Getting the animals from the terrible conditions to places like lions, tigers, and bears, and trying to stop this terrible abuse.
Thank you. And what cherished memories do you have while you were here at Lions, Tigers, and Bears?
There are so many good memories here. The people here are incredible. My team is incredible. The animals are incredible. And just watching them go from something bad to something good and, you know, gaining weight and getting shiny and thriving, it's a pretty awesome feeling.
Bobby really does amazing work here. This is Miriam again. I certainly have one of my own treasured memories of this place. The day you opened up the Tiger Trails enclosure, and we were here, and these were tigers that had spent, you know, their whole life before they came here in something like a 10x10 enclosure. And you built this marvelous field that was probably about the size of a football field, and it had a pond, a lake with a waterfall, and just the expression on these tigers' faces when they realized they could run freely for the first time, and one of them finally jumped in the water and was swimming around, and it sure did look like he was smiling.
Priceless, isn't it? Priceless.
You're also involved in trying to do some things to stop the abuse of these animals at the national level. Tell us about that, Bobby.
Well, we kind of follow the legislation around and try to clean up the mess, per se, because the sanctuaries are the ones that come in and fix everything. When people lose their animals, or they surrender their animals, or they've taken them on as a pet and they have no place to go. So we work all over the country. We've been to New York, North Carolina, Florida. We've been to almost every state and rescued animals, and we work with a big group of sanctuaries. So it's really hard to find homes for these animals, so we work together with other sanctuaries. We're one of the only sanctuaries that have a proper transport. It's set up with full first aid for animals, full first aid for humans, onboard anesthesia. It's self-contained. It's temperature controlled. It's perfect for transporting, and that's a way that we can help other sanctuaries and the first responders, and we work with state authorities and things like that.
So you've got a fifth wheeler out here too, and tell me how you use that.
Right, we use our hauler all across the country. We can haul six bears or six tigers at one time, and it's an awesome machine because it's fully self-contained and it's comfortable for the animals and it's safe, and that's how we get them from point A to point B. And a lot of times we literally have to go in and build something. A lot of people don't, when they take on an animal as a pet, they never think about moving it, or they never think about it having to come out of that cage.
And the pet trade is really cruel with these animals. I know that you were telling me that with the latest tiger cub, they take them away from the mothers at such an early age.
Right. A lot of times they'll pull them from the mother really young, before their eyes are even open. And a person who's, you know, having a tiger as a pet, they might not know how to properly feed it. So we, just like with Himmel here, we had all the malnutrition problems. And it brings the female back into heat, and they breed more babies. It's all about breeding babies.
It's illegal in California to own these exotic animals, and I understand you're working at the federal level to try to make it illegal in every state.
Well, IFA is actually working on the federal bill right now.
And IFA?
IFA, which is International Fund for Animal Welfare, along with some other animal organizations.
Speaking of building, you mentioned that you are working on a brand new habitat facility that you're raising money for currently. Can you tell us about that?
Right. We are trying to raise the funds for our next habitat, which will be probably about 3 acres in size. It'll be very large. It'll be able to house at least 3 bears or up to 6 cats. And so to build this, it'll be about $280,000. And I know that sounds like a lot, but we actually will be able to raise the money by, you know, our members that give the $25, $100, $50. It all adds up and we will get the job done and we'll be able to rescue some more animals.
Excellent. And you also do events here. I know today it looks like you're setting up for Princess Cruises coming in this weekend.
Yes, we have Princess Cruises coming in. So we'll have about 350 people tomorrow. And it'll just be a lunch and fun and open house. And it'll be a good day.
Very good. If people want to get more information about lions, tigers, and bears, or they'd like to become a member or donate and help support the good works you're doing at Lion, Tigers, and Bears, where can they get that information?
They can just go to our website, www.lionstigersandbears.org. Everything is plural and is spelled out. Or they can call the office and make an appointment and come on out.
And what's that number?
619-659-8078.
Are you looking for volunteers?
We're always looking for volunteers, so come help us to help the animals.
Very good. Bobby, I'm going to let you have the final say. Is there anything else that you would like our listeners to know today about lions, tigers, and bears?
Big cats and bears need your help. And if you're an animal lover like I am, please come out and volunteer and please come out and help us. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you for joining us on the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice.
Thank you.
You are listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea.
Welcome to the Public News Service Daily Newscast for Monday, November the 9th, 2015. I'm Mike Clifford. Among the stories on a nationwide rundown, college students prepare for a nationwide million student march. At issue, tens of thousands in student debt. Concerns about liquefied natural gas facilities and water issues, plus an update on outreach to women in uniform. Now our top story, students across the nation tired of waiting for leaders to fix what they see as a crisis in higher education. That's why they are calling for a million student march later this week. Eric Galatis has more.
On Thursday, students from over 100 campuses will join a national day of action demanding tuition-free public college, cancellation of all student debt, and a $15 minimum wage for all campus workers. Elon Axelbank, an organizer at Northeastern University in Boston, says continued state budget cuts and rising tuition costs have created an education crisis. He says in the richest nation in the world, students shouldn't have to take on what he calls crippling debt to get a college degree.
So in order for you to get an education, you have to take out loans from these private industries who are profiting off of the fact that we just want to get an education so that we can contribute to society in the best way that we possibly can.
Axelbank says on average, this year's class of college graduates will have to pay back over $35,000 in student loans. He points to U.S. government data showing more than 40 million people share over $1 trillion in debt, and he says 58% of that is held by the poorest 25% of Americans.
The Facebook event page for Texas State University's San Marcos campus invites all comers, and we're told if your campus is not involved yet, there's still time to sign up at studentmarch.org. And speaking of actions, young people expected to take to the streets in the nation's capital today to demand action on race, climate, and immigration. The protest is being called Our Generation, Our Choice. Organizers say groups involved will include United We Dream, Million Hoodies, and 350.org. Earlier this year, Minnesota was ranked the top state for the well-being of children, but a children's advocacy group is touring the state to show there's still work to be done.
According to the Children's Defense Fund Minnesota, the state's child poverty rate rose 3% from 2008 to 2013. Stephanie Hoganson, research and policy director for the Defense Fund, says that problem's being highlighted in the latest Minnesota Kids Count data book, which is also being released this week.
This year's data book really focuses on increasing access to opportunities for children of color and American Indian children. We have many great programs and policies that are implemented across the state, but not all children who are eligible can access them.
Hoganson hopes this year's Kids Count Coffee Tour, which starts Tuesday in Minneapolis, will help communities and lawmakers continue to talk about which programs are working and which are not. I'm Brandon Campbell, reporting.
The 2015 Kids Count Coffee Tour will stop in more than a dozen Minnesota communities through the end of this month. More than 20 environmental and civic groups have delivered a letter to New York Governor Cuomo asking him to veto a liquefied natural gas facility. Andrea Sears says it's called the Port Ambrose Project.
Following 4 days of public hearings last week, the governor has until December 21st to stop the offshore liquefied natural gas facility proposed for 20 miles from Long Island's Jones Beach. Jessica Roth of Catskill Mountain Keeper says the port is unnecessary and hazardous.
It's incredibly dangerous. It's destructive to the ocean floor, to the water, to the air, and then anything that relies on the ocean for its livelihood.
Liberty Natural Gas, the developer of the project, says the port would stabilize the natural gas supply and lower the price in a region that has some of the highest gas prices in the country. The public comment period on Port Ambrose ends on November 30th. Either Governor Cuomo or New Jersey Governor Chris Christie can veto the project.
And sticking with the environment, time running out now for Congress to pass the Klamath Basin Restoration Agreement. Chris Thomas tells us at the White House Tribal Nations Conference late last week, there were glimmers of hope it could still be possible.
President Obama told the group he's committed to working with tribal nations to protect natural resources and honor their heritage. Kathy Hill with the Klamath Tribes was there and says she heard mixed views about the future of the water agreement.
Sally Jewell was optimistic, but then another person, not with the administration, told me, you know, nothing's going to get through this House this year. And you know, that's the mood, I think, maybe in Washington, D.C.
The agreement covers water use in Southern Oregon and Northern California. It was hammered out by more than 40 parties, but it expires at the end of this year without congressional approval.
And finally, as Veterans Day approaches, a new program for women who have served in the U.S. Armed Forces is gaining attention and support. Greg Steidelmeyer has more from Kentucky.
There are around 22 million veterans in America, and 331,000 of them live in Kentucky, including nearly 25,000 who are women. Kentucky's Department of Veterans Affairs has made increasing outreach to women vets a priority this year. The state's Commissioner of Veterans Affairs, Heather French Henry, says a key focus is helping them transition back into the civilian workforce.
Women veterans have a higher percentage of unemployment rate than their male counterparts.
The U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs projects that over the next 30 years, the percentage of veterans who are women will increase from around 10% to around 17%.
That's our news for now. I'm Mike Clifford for Public News Service, member and listener supported, and online at publicnewsservice.org.
In God We Trust is printed on every piece of paper money that the U.S. Mint produces, but few Americans may be trusting God than in the past, according to a new poll conducted by the Pew Research Center. The poll found that nearly a quarter of American adults surveyed said they are atheistic, agnostic, or nothing in particular, a 16% increase over the past 7 years. The percentage of religious Americans, or as the poll calls them, people who are absolutely certain God exists, dropped 8% to 63% over the same time frame. The percentage of Americans who pray daily, attend some type of religious service, and or consider religion to be an important part of their lives also fell slightly. Religions are facing internal changes too. 10 News reports, for example, the Pew Research poll results showed a higher amount of Christians who believe that homosexuality should be accepted. Reporting on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Liz Alper.
This is East County Magazine's Tribal Beat, bringing you news for and about our region's Native American communities. U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders and Senator Tammy Baldwin introduced legislation this week to stop the transfer of federal land to a foreign-owned corporation, which plans to develop the largest copper mine in North America and reap $61 billion from U.S. taxpayer assets from land sacred to Native Americans. The land known as Oak Flat is a plateau hidden from the Sonoran Desert below by towering cliffs known as Apache Leap. The land is an oasis concealed by mountain peaks located in the Tonto National Forest near the ghost-like mining town of Superior, Arizona. The night before voting to approve the 2015 National Defense Authorization Act, a must-pass bill, Senator John McCain slipped in a provision that approved the transfer of Oak Flat to a private foreign corporation, Rio Tinto, and its subsidiary, Resolution Copper, to mine the land using a block cave method, which would create a crater 2 miles long and 1,000 feet deep, without any public input or debate on the Senate floor. Senator Sanders said, "Too many times our Native American brothers and sisters have seen the profits of huge corporations put ahead of their sovereign rights. It is wrong that a backroom deal in Washington could lead to the destruction of a sacred area that is so important to so many. We must defend the hundreds of thousands of Americans who are standing in opposition to this giveaway of our natural resources to foreign corporations." Oak Flat has been part of Apache history for centuries. Oak Flat and the Tonto National Forest was established in 1905 from the ancestral homelands of the Tonto Apache and other Native Americans who were forcibly removed at gunpoint from the Oak Flat area by the U.S. Army in the 1880s. The Apaches were held as prisoners of war until the early 1900s. It is easy to see why this oasis in the Sonoran Desert is sacred to the Apache. Once on top of the plateau, one has a feeling of entering a different world from the Sonoran Desert below. Surrounded by mountain peaks, ancient oak trees with trunks the size of boulders, cool water from springs form natural pools in the shade. Water flows from the Gayan Creek and the Queen Creek Canyon. There are nearly 2,000 hiking and climbing trails. The Resolution Copper Mining Company estimates that the crater at Oak Flat resulting from the underground block cave mining would be 2 miles wide and 1,000 feet deep at the center. The mine would be the largest excavation project in North America, leaving a crater so large it would be visible from outer space. Groundwater and subterranean aquifers percolate into the caverns, becoming lifeless, deadly, poisoned ponds birds won't even land on. The company estimates 1.7 billion tons of mine waste tailings and billions of gallons of sulfuric acid-polluted water will remain in the 760-acre Oak Flat area, which was deemed off-limits to future mining by a 1955 land order signed by President Dwight D. Eisenhower. Because of their religious, historical, and cultural value, Oak Flat and the Tonto National Forest are protected under the National Historic Preservation Act, the American Indian Religious Freedom Act, and most of all, the will of the American people who have called for this kind of egregious political payoff to end. Representative Raul Grijalva from Tucson introduced the bill in the House of Representatives earlier this year, and the legislation currently has 36 bipartisan co-sponsors. The Save Oak Flat Act would repeal Section 3003 from the Defense Authorization Act and prevent a dangerous legal precedent concerning important tribal areas located on federal lands, like the Ocotillo Wind Farm in San Diego County and oil pipelines across pristine wild rice lakes in Minnesota. One opponent to the Oak Flat proposal said, "People from across the country and even around the world are outraged by what's happening with Oak Flat and won't stand by to see our public lands and American Indian sacred sites be destroyed for profits." On Wednesday, the signatures of over 1 million people, including many from San Diego, were submitted in favor of saving Oak Flat. The signatures were turned in ahead of the House Natural Resources Committee Forum on Protecting Sacred American Sites. "Oak Flat should be protected, not plundered," asserted Nick Kimbrell, a senior campaigner with AVAZ. "Over 1 million people in the U.S. and around the world are calling on Congress to stop this act of cultural vandalism and set a precedent for governments everywhere to protect Native peoples and their sacred sites." This has been Leon Thompson for East County Magazine on KNSJ.
This is Helen Ofield from the Lemon Grove Historical Society bringing you the sounds of history.
In the dimly lit confines of the fruit-packing plants that once dotted East County, men and women, but mainly women, worked as sorters and packers of lemons and oranges bound for rail shipment to points across America. Today, we bring you a little memoir of life in a fruit-packing plant during the Great Depression, written by Estelle Tooker of Tennessee. Her discussion of making ends meet with a little daughter to raise and an ailing war veteran husband to care for will resonate with many modern people. Here are her words, written in 1979, when she was 78 years old. My husband, Earl Tooker, and I, with our 2-year-old daughter, Ione, arrived in San Diego by train from Sioux City, Iowa, in January 1923. We had $50 and very little else. We stayed in a hotel, eating our meals out, and it soon became obvious our $50 was not going to last. But it was our good fortune when a realtor told us we could rent a little place in Lemon Grove for $15. We had no idea where Lemon Grove was, but the important thing was that we would have a place to live and still have a few dollars left until Earl's pension check would arrive. He was a disabled World War I veteran, gassed in France by the Germans, and we had come to California because of his poor health. So there we were in our little place, located on the west side of Old Imperial Avenue, running through Lemon Grove. There was 3 rooms, furnished with a kerosene-burning stove for cooking, a table, a chair or two, and a bed. There were some chickens, good laying hens, and the remains of what had been a little vegetable garden. So we had plenty of eggs, and we had carrots and peas, and that was it. When the rainy season began in January, our tar paper roof developed many holes. Before the season ended, we were expert in keeping dry with every available pot and pan to catch the water. But it was so cold, we resorted to wrapping ourselves in throw rugs to keep warm. By February, our $50 was long gone, and the expected pension check from the government did not arrive. We knew no one in Lemon Grove except Tony Sonka, who ran the general store, so we took the gold wristwatch my parents had given me on my 18th birthday and gave it to Mr. Sonka as security for groceries until our money came. He was so kind and generous to us. Then we were offered a chance to move and live rent-free in another house in Lemon Grove, and in return, we took care of the house, the chickens, the garden, the berry bushes, and the nanny goats who supplied us with a lot of milk. My husband, Earl, was a telegraph operator by trade, and when his health permitted, he worked as relief man for all the different stations on the San Diego and Arizona Railway line, which ran from San Diego to Yuma, Arizona. In 1927, he got the permanent job as depot agent at the railroad depot located across the street from Sonka's store in Lemon Grove, and that's when I went to work at the packing house, packing lemons. My husband's duties at the depot consisted of receiving and delivering telegrams, sealing and routing the loaded cars of lemons being shipped out of the grove, and handling freight and supplies to the growers all over town. He worked there till 1931, when his health failed completely. My work at the packing house consisted of 2 departments where women did most of the work. We took turns. When the lemons were first brought in from the orchards, they were green, hard as rock. They were dumped into a huge tank, filled with some kind of solution, washed with big brushes. That was a two-man job, back and forth and back and forth. And then they came out on a conveyor belt in all sizes. Two women to a box, picked them off the belt, grading by size and quality. They were then taken to the basement and stored until time to pack for shipping. And that season began in May. A lemon packer was paid higher than a washer, but it was piecework. You had to pack 10,000 lemons a day in order to earn $3. On a good day, we would earn $4 or $5. Minimum wage was 33 and a third cents an hour. That was the Great Depression. But still, it was fascinating to watch those women work, all standing beside the moving belt, lemons tumbling along so fast, all arms reaching out to pick a lemon, and as if with one movement, a methodical swish, a simple twist of the hand into a square piece of labeled sun-kissed paper and into the box. Then with lightning speed, a packer would swing the box around, fill the other half, place a card on top, swing it to another belt going in the opposite direction, and start another box. The packed one was then lidded in an operation performed by the pressman. We never knew when one of our boxes would be inspected. If it passed inspection, we got paid for an extra box. We had to repack the entire box if it did not pass inspection. The lemon sizes were based on the number of lemons it took to fill a packed box. Some of those sizes were 300, 360, 520, and so on. As many as 200 freight cars of lemons a season were shipped from Lemon Grove. The season was May through September, but washing those lemons was more or less all year round. I'll always remember our close friends and neighbors from that time. We made a little bit of money, and they all came by to see our very first washing machine. Y'all might know that big lemon. My husband was part of building it in 1928. We never dreamed it would become a permanent historical landmark, but it's still there. In 1934, my husband was sent up to the Veterans Hospital in San Fernando, and for a year, we tried to keep him alive and keep him in a good climate, but he finally died. He passed away on October 25, 1937. My daughter and I returned to our old house, the one we very first moved into in Lemon Grove, and my daughter graduated from Grossmont High School in 1938, and at that time, we left Lemon Grove forever. But I will never forget it, because that little town kept us alive all through the Depression. And there you have it, dear listeners. For the Sound of History, I'm Helen Ofield.
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the East County Wellness Center for our studio space, to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County and Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technicians, Leon Thompson and Ed Barena, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats, Donnie Gentile, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, Royalty Free Music, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection. We also thank the County of San Diego for a community enhancement grant to support our Destination East County segment. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.